The owners initially refused, until a subtle nod from Aida completed the transaction. They stepped outside into the setting sun, just as the melodic call to evening prayer echoed above them.
"I'm sorry if I bored you with too much history today, Jack. You Americans are fortunate because you always look toward the future.
Your history is fascinating. I wasn't bored at all. I'm looking forward to coming back soon."
"It's too bad you're leaving tomorrow.
I wish we had more time together." Jack hadn't expected that.
"I'd like that too.
How about dinner?"
"I'm sorry, but I have much work to do tonight at the office. I still own the tour business, and tomorrow we have a new group of refugees coming to the center.
Can I come and see it tomorrow?"
"I thought you were leaving."
"Let me check in with my boss and clear it with him."
"It's nothing glamorous, Jack. I'm sure you'll be bored."
"I want to help out if I can." She sized him up and down again.
"Come if you want. Or not. Either way, I hope your mother likes the earrings."
"Trust me, she will."
"You have my number. I'll be in the office until late if you change your mind."
She extended her hand. Jack took it. Neither bothered to let go. The heat in her hand matched the warmth of her eyes. "I'll call you later either way."
"Ciao, Jack."
"Ciao." Aida turned and walked away, confident that Jack's eyes were fixed on her every step as she disappeared into the crowds of tourists. She was right. Chapter 40. When Jack got back to his apartment, he threw a load of laundry into the tiny washer-dryer combo unit in the kitchen. He had to Google instructions for it. Apparently, you needed a degree in electrical engineering to operate one of these things. As near as he could tell, it was going to take at least 6 hours to finish a load. He was down to his last pair of skivvies, the jeans he was wearing, and a faded Arcade Fire concert t-shirt, so he had to do it. Flying back to D.C. in dirty clothes wasn't an option. Shit. Flying back to D.C. period isn't what he wanted to do. He couldn't stop thinking about Aida. Yeah, she was a looker for sure. But there was something else about her. Smart, compassionate, committed. Well, yeah. And freaking hot. Lucky for him, he was able to extend his stay at the apartment because it wasn't booked for another 5 days. The place was so good and the rent so cheap, he grabbed all five, partly as a favor to his struggling young landlords, and partly so he could stop thinking about it. It was a great place, at half the price of a Fleabag motel in Virginia. But Virginia was home, and where his job was. And so back to Virginia he needed to go. Oh well. After tossing in the load, he pulled out his phone to face the dragon. But to his pleasant surprise, the two voicemails that Jerry had left weren't royal ass-chewings, only pleased to call him when he got the chance. It was 6 hours earlier in Alexandria, and despite the coffee and baklava, Jack was hungry and knew he wouldn't get the chance to eat chivapi again, so he headed back to the same restaurant. He dialed Jerry's number while he was walking. His boss picked up on the first ring.
"Hello, kid. Glad you finally called. I was getting worried."
"No worries. I was out of pocket today."
"I thought you were supposed to be on that flight back today. What happened?"
"Nothing. I just decided to extend my trip another day."
"Still haven't found that girl?"
"Actually, I did."
"And you gave her your mother's letter?"
"Yep."
"Great. So you'll be on the first plane tomorrow, right?"
Jack crossed the Latin Bridge. He was about to tell Jerry about his decision to stay at least one more day, but there was something in Jerry's voice.
"Why do you ask? Has something come up?"
"I'm just concerned about the Slovenian situation."
"Did that woman finally get around to filing charges against me?"
"No, Jack. She's dead."
"What? How?"
The light turned green and Jack marched past the assassination corner without noticing. Heart attack. She was under police protection at the time,
still recovering from the adult spanking you gave her. Why was she under police protection? The cops knew I left for Sarajevo. She said she was afraid you'd come back to hurt her. That doesn't make any sense. Either she was crazy, or she was afraid of somebody else coming to get her and used me for an excuse to get protection. Bingo. The Slovenian cops suspect foul play. She was murdered or committed suicide. Either way, we think she might be a gun monkey for an outfit called the Iron Syndicate. Mean anything to you? Never heard of them. We're dry on our end, too, but we're shaking a few trees. Gently. Still can't confirm anything. Then there's nothing to worry about. It's the fact we can't confirm one way or another that's got me worried, son. If they exist, and we're having this hard of a time finding them, they're a serious outfit. And they're gunning for you. I'll keep my head on a swivel, Jack said, hearing Clark's raspy training voice shouting in the back of his brain. But I'm not worried. Just be damn sure to get on that plane tomorrow, will you? Jack arrived at the restaurant. Gotta run, Jerry. I'll be in touch. Text me when your butt's in the seat, okay? Got it. Ciao. What? See you soon. Jack hung up and searched for an open seat. There weren't any. Jack waited for a few minutes and found himself scanning the crowd more closely than he otherwise would. If that woman really was a hired hitter and she was dead, whoever paid her would send somebody else. But how would this syndicate know he was in Sarajevo? The same way they knew he was in Ljubljana. Yeah, these guys have resources. But like Jerry said, nothing was confirmed. And if they really were out there, they were as likely to come after him in the States as here. And he wasn't one to hide. Jack caught sight of a tall Muslim man in a traditional cotton tunic and pants pushing a stroller, followed closely by a woman dressed head to toe in black, only her eyes showing where the niqab barely parted. They entered the restaurant directly. A funny thought struck Jack. How does that woman eat in a restaurant? Does she slip the chivapi sausage up underneath her robe? And what about spaghetti or a hamburger? Or does she expose her face when she eats in public? A moment later, a man and woman got up from a group table just outside the door. Jack figured out they were seating family style, at least at dinner, so he slipped over in that direction, asking with pointed gestures if it was available. To judge from the smiles and nods he received, it was. He took a seat. Just then, the burqa-clad woman and her husband passed by Jack, exiting the restaurant with takeout boxes full of food and a happy toddler babbling in the stroller. Burqa problem solved, Jack noted. His chivapi arrived hot and was just as tasty as he remembered. It didn't take him long to devour the meal, but he enjoyed it a little less than he had before, because he found himself keeping one eye on the passing crowds as he ate. Jack imagined an assassin's bullet plowing into his skull with his mouth full of sausage and onions. Not a pretty picture. Other than that, Mr. Ryan, how was the chivapi? For some reason, though, he wasn't scared. More like annoyed that someone wanted to ruin his vacation. Jerry wanted him to tuck tail and run back home. That was the smart play, he had to admit. The Slovenian cop Oblak knew he was coming here. And strangely, the Bosnian cop Kolak knew it too. Someone wanted him dead and followed him to Slovenia. Someone else could be here in Sarajevo right now for the same damn reason. Leaving made a lot of sense. But he couldn't get the image of Aida out of his mind. If he left tomorrow, there wasn't a chance in hell he'd ever see her again. His last two failed relationships proved that. But if he got his brains blown out like a Sarajevo rose on the limestone pavement, that would cramp his dating life as well. Hell of a dilemma. Well, Clark always said, a dumb guy thinks with his head, and a smart guy thinks with his brain. True that. Jack peeled off enough Bosnian marks to pay the tab, along with a generous tip, and headed back out onto the street, ducking into a crowded souvenir shop with two exits.
He purchased a blue and gold dragon ball cap, the Bosnian national soccer team, and switched it out with the one he was wearing, which he stuffed in his waistband and hid beneath his shirt. He headed out of the second exit, keeping the corners of his eyes glued to the window glass across the street to see if he was being followed. He continued his SDR for another 30 minutes, alternately wearing one hat and then another, always careful to keep his face pointed away from any surveillance cameras that might be around, including the ones on ATMs. Satisfied that he wasn't being tailed and feeling just a little stupid for being paranoid, he dialed Aida's number, hoping she hadn't changed her mind. He'd just have to figure out what to tell Jerry tomorrow when he wasn't on that plane. Fuck the Iron Syndicate. Chapter 41. Near Tientiste, Republika Srpska, Bosnia and Herzegovina. Brkić listened carefully to Red Wing's electronically altered voice, but he still couldn't believe what he was hearing. "It's extreme, yes, I agree," Red Wing said, "but necessary, if we want the referendum to fail." Brkić still wasn't sure about Red Wing's order. It hadn't been part of their plan. But their plan so far hadn't entirely worked either. Extraordinary measures were called for now, if they were to succeed. Red Wing was right, even if it was for the wrong reason. Red Wing was often right, Brkić reminded himself. He'd known the man for a long time, shed blood with him. Red Wing had even saved his life. That meant something, didn't it? More than the money and the weapons and the networks he provided. A debt that Brkić could never repay. And yet, Brkić had other loyalties. And another plan. He was glad he'd never told Red Wing about it, or the missiles. Their alliance was one of mutual convenience, an arranged marriage. But this new order reminded Brkić that Red Wing's loyalties were not his own in the grand scheme of things. How could they be? Red Wing was neither Bosnian nor Chechen. Yes, you're right. It must be done. Excellent. You are still following the protocol. A new phone every day. Yes, of course. Call me when it's done. Brkić ended the call and tossed the phone into the crackling burn barrel that was keeping the night chill away. The phone popped in the fire, sending a burst of sparks floating up into the dark pine branches above his head, triggering a memory of another forest years ago, when his name was still Rizvan Sadaev. Poljanica, Bosnia and Herzegovina, 1992. Sadaev heard the sputtering twin air-cooled radial piston engines low in the cloudy night sky long before he saw the plane. The 1,200 feet of narrow dirt road servicing the small village saw double duty tonight as an airstrip for the rugged warhorse, a converted Vietnam-era Douglas C-47, a faded Greek Air Cargo Company logo painted on its bullet-riddled fuselage. A radio call from the plane was the signal for him and 5 other vehicles to turn on their headlights to illumine the road, a thin thread of hard-packed dirt wending its way between villages tucked between the thick swaths of forested hills and wide grassy pasture lands of the Bila Valley. Central Bosnia was still a Muslim stronghold, but was under siege by Serb and Croat forces. Sadaev was a junior commander in a unit of foreign jihadis in Bosnia, Bosanski Muzahidi, fighting independently from the Bosnian army. The other foreign jihadi fighters in country were organized by the Bosnian government into the El Muzahid, a unit they kept under their tight control. Sadaev's unit wanted no such control. The plane landed with a heavy bounce and came to a hard-braking stop just short of the tree line. They began unloading the first crates of weapons, food, and ammunition before the engines had feathered to a stop. The agent bringing the much-needed supplies jumped out of the cargo area and greeted Sadaev with a firm handshake. He identified himself only as Red Wing, but his reputation as a fighter and his recommendation by trusted friends were all the credentials he needed. Sadaev introduced him to the other commanders in his unit,
two Tunisians, four Saudis, a Libyan, and a fellow Chechen.
Where are the other planes? Sadaev asked.
Delayed. Red Wing smiled as he pointed at the bullet holes stitched into the aluminum fuselage. We were lucky to get through.
We have an operation that begins in 48 hours, and the Serbs have tanks. Our weapons are useless against them.
The Chechen was dismayed. The vintage American plane carried only 7,500 pounds of cargo.
I brought what you need for now. The rest will be here within the week.
Inshallah, Sadaev said. God willing.
Red Wing smiled.
Yes, of course.
Sadaev wasn't ungrateful. The UN arms embargo served only to cripple the Bosniaks' ability to resist their murderous neighbors. Illegal arms shipments from the Libyans, Saudis, Turks, and others gave their Muslim brothers a fighting chance. Rumors were the German BND supplied embargoed arms to the Croatians, and the Serbs could always count on Serbia and the Russians. Without men like Red Wing, the Bosniaks were doomed. But Sadaev was under no illusion. Red Wing fought against the Western powers, but Sadaev and his men fought for Allah.
But such is God's way, he thought, to use unbelievers to accomplish his will.
We'll discuss your operational plans later, my friend. Red Wing clapped Sadaev on his broad shoulder.
I have an idea you might appreciate.
He turned around and helped unload the next crate out of the door. Sadaev and the others joined in. It would be light in a few hours.
2 days later, a four-wheel-drive Bosnian Serb Army BOV-30 armored personnel carrier skidded to a halt in a cloud of dust. Its twin-mounted 30-millimeter guns on its rectangular turret swept the village square in an ominous arc, scanning the small, neat Bosniak houses for resistance.
Nothing. A moment later, a Serbian sergeant emerged from the cupola and scanned the area with his binoculars. All clear. He lowered himself back down and radioed the convoy commander. His 10-ton high-speed scout vehicle did double duty racing ahead of the column, confirming that neither mines nor enemy forces were located on the road or in the village. They would stay put until the convoy arrived and dismounted infantry cleared the houses. Even if the civilians had fled, the village would have to be razed and the wells poisoned before they moved on to the next Bosniak enclave. The Serb column rumbled down the dirt road, flanked on the left by a thick band of pines 50 meters away and a wide grassy meadow on the right, stretching more than a kilometer to the woods. The lead tank in the column was an M-84. A Serbian-produced variant of the Russian T-72, with a 125-millimeter smoothbore auto-loading gun and a three-man crew, including the convoy commander, a captain in the regular army of the Republika Srpska. Both the captain and his gunner stood in the hatches, despite the threat, however unlikely, of sniper fire. The cramped, uncomfortable turret was a particular torture for the 6-foot-tall captain, especially when buttoned up. The turret's primary purpose wasn't crew comfort, but rather to house the tank's autoloader, an ingenious Soviet design that reduced the crew size by 25%. The autoloader could generate up to 8 shots per minute, cycling the separate carousels of both charges and projectiles into the cannon's breech in a seamless mechanical motion. When the autoloader operated, the captain felt like a midget riding inside a giant semi-automatic pistol, as toaster-sized propellant charges and arm-length explosive rounds clunked through the mechanism just inches from his shoulder. The crew compartment carried 39 rounds of heat, armor-piercing, and HE frag shells. Even when the gun wasn't firing, the vehicle at cruising speed echoed with the deafening roar of the tank's grinding steel tracks and the relentless V-12 diesel engine. Pitiful electric fans hardly blew away the fumes, let alone the heat. The captain's TKN-3 primary optical sight and 2 episcopes were barely adequate under combat conditions, and practically useless otherwise. Better to ride the hatch and risk getting shot than stay hot, blind, and deaf for hours for no good reason.
The captain confirmed his scout's radio report and gave his gunner a thumbs up. He turned around for another visual check on the convoy behind him. 30 meters behind was the first of 5 FAP 2026 six-wheel drive trucks, loaded with heavily armed Serb White Eagles militia infantry, already infamous for their brutality against Muslim civilians. At least a third of the militia platoon were felons recruited straight out of prison, valued for their insatiable appetites for violence and mayhem. The last vehicle in the convoy was another M84 tank. It would be dark soon. If the village really was empty, they'd bivouac there tonight and head out first thing in the morning after destroying it. Then they would proceed to assault the next village in the valley. With any luck, they'd cleanse the entire district of Muslims within a week. Poorly equipped and led, the Bosnian army had put up virtually no resistance in the area. You could hardly even call it a war, the captain mused, with 41 tons of steel rumbling beneath him. His frontal armor could withstand direct hits by 105mm tank guns and tow missiles, neither of which the Bosniaks possessed in this region. His tanks were invulnerable. Chapter 42. The Chechen Sadaev crouched at the base of the pine tree, the heavy bulk of the RPG-29 Vampir rocket launcher supported on the folding tripod behind the pistol grip. At this close distance, he could have tracked the lead Serb tank through the iron flip sights, but his eye was pressed against the rubber cup of the magnified PGO-29 glass optics for extra accuracy. His finger slipped from the guard to the trigger and squeezed. The pulled trigger ignited the electronic fuse of the PG-29V, a 105mm tandem rocket with a shaped heat charge capable of penetrating 750mm of homogeneous armor, far thicker than the frontal composite sloped plating of the M84 tank, let alone its far thinner sides. The gunner whipped around in his hatch at the familiar sound of the rocket motor launching in the woods to his left and gazed in horror at the long plume of exhaust racing toward his tank. The shaped heat charge slammed into the thin steel wall behind the wheels. The eruption produced a hypersonic jet of molten metal and flaming gases, cutting through the 20mm steel hull like a plasma laser, incinerating the driver's atomizing corpse before his first scream. The 39 rounds of ammunition stores inside the hull ignited in a near-instantaneous chain reaction. The lower torsos of the gunner and commander were sheared away by the overpressure and shrapnel, but their upper bodies were still intact as the flaming turret cartwheeled high into the air, before tumbling into the road with a thunderous clang. The Serb tank commander in the rear of the column ducked instinctively back into his hatch when he saw the plume of rocket smoke racing out of the woods at the lead tank, shouting orders at the driver to break right away from the trees. The gunner, meanwhile, took the opposite tack and threw himself off the turret and onto the road, about the time a second heat round slammed into his vehicle. His act of cowardice saved his life, at least for another 3 seconds, when the white-hot shrapnel of the exploding tank shredded him like creamed chipped beef as he screamed in the dirt. Some of the panicked White Eagles dove out of the trucks as they lurched off the road in a cloud of diesel fumes away from the nearby woods, racing for the relative safety of the tree line on the far side of the lush green meadow. Automatic rifle fire erupted from the woods behind them now, kicking up turf around the lumbering vehicles as they swayed and bounced on the soft grass. Wham! 3 of the trucks plowed into buried landmines. Flesh and canvas and steel erupted in a cloud of screams and boiling fire. The remaining 2 trucks slammed their brakes just in time. The survivors leaped out of the cargo beds and bolted for cover, as a hail of 7.62mm bullets stormed into them, fired by the line of shouting Mujahideen, rifles up, faces twisted with pious joy and battle rage as they charged out of the trees toward the broken Serb column. Suddenly, a line of 20-millimeter shells stitched across the surging wave of jihadis, breaking them open like climbing knives, spilling their butchered torsos into the pine needles in a spray of blood and shattered flesh. The rotors of the Serb SA-341 Gazelle helicopter beat the air as it whirled around for a second pass with its Giat M621 20-millimeter cannon. But its cabin-mounted 7.62-millimeter machine gun started pouring on the fire toward the trees. More jihadis fell as the Serbs gathered their courage, opening fire from prone positions across the road in the tall meadow grass. The French-built Serb aircraft, with its enclosed Fenestron tail rotor assembly, swooped in a broad arc overhead to regain altitude and to draw a bead on the tree line. Sadaev felt the overpressure of the metal-jacketed 7.62s buzzing past, cutting tree branches above his head and smashing trunks behind him. Crack! A round slammed into the tree he lay next to, stinging the left side of his face, his left eye blinded with his own hot blood. He wiped it away with his hand as he pressed himself into the dirt and pine needles, waiting for the Serb volley of fire to cease. When it did, he jumped to his feet, pulled out his pistol from his leg holster, and shouted orders to his men to follow him to glory. He bolted out of the tree line, keeping the flaming lead tank between himself and the Serbs in the far meadow. But as his feet hit the dirt, he heard the sickening whir of a 20-millimeter chain gun far above him. He glanced up just in time to see the rooster tail of dirt 100 yards away racing toward him, cutting down more brothers in their tracks. Sadaev shouted, "Allahu Akbar!" knowing that his death was a blink away, until a speeding finger of smoke reached into the sky, smashing the gazelle in a crushing, fiery fist. Sadaev shouted again as the flaming wreckage tumbled toward the earth, his good right eye tracking the smoke trail back to its source on the ground. Red Wing lowered the 9K-38 Igla Needle, a Russian man-pads, man-portable air defense system. He stood completely exposed in the middle of the road, dust kicking up all around him from Serb bullets fired in his direction. Sadaev nodded his thanks as Red Wing tossed the Igla aside and pulled out his own pistol, following Sadaev toward the Serbs in the meadow at a full run. The surviving Serbs knelt in a line in the dirt of the village square, close enough to the smoldering wreck of the BOV-30 scout vehicle to smell the burnt flesh inside. Wounded in battle or bleeding from their brutal interrogations, the 7 White Eagles struggled to stay on their knees, their hands clasped behind their heads and their uniform collars secured by the hands of the Saudi and Tunisian jihadis standing behind them. Sadaev nodded his command. His left eye was heavily bandaged and his tunic blackened with his own dried blood. 7 razor-sharp serrated blades flashed in unison above the Serbians' heads, and the 7 jihadis shouted, "Allahu Akbar!" as one. To the Serbs' credit, none of them wailed like women, Sadaev noted as the blades opened up their throats and hot blood spewed into the dust. But they all struggled as the sharp blades continued their gruesome work. Minutes later, the severed heads were set on a wall, and several of Sadaev's men posed smiling and laughing next to their grimacing trophies. They held up a black Aqab flag between them for a picture. A Jordanian shouted encouragement as he snapped photos with his 35-millimeter film camera. "I understand the brothers have carried out similar operations against the Orthodox in the east," Red Wing said, watching the other fighters cutting off the White Eagles' unit patches from the corpse's uniforms. "We Mujahideen are the sword of Allah. Our Bosniak brothers haven't the stomach for such things. But with more weapons, we will prevail against these Serb wolves, even if the sheepish brothers won't join us. What will you do after you win the war?" "It's good country here. I will take a Bosniak wife. Perhaps even change my name. Raise up an army of sons to keep the land and raise the flag over all of Europe someday." "I have no doubt you will prevail, my friend. But if you should lose, then what?" Sadaev laughed. "The same. We never lose. We only wait." He clapped Red Wing on his shoulder.
You are a good fighter. We can use you here. I wish you would stay. There are as many wars to fight as there are trees. I go where I am needed. Like a bird, flying to your next branch. Where to next?
Red Wing only smiled. He wasn't at liberty to say. Said I have understood.
Perhaps we will meet again, in this life or the next. Inshallah.
Yes, in this life or the next. But this life would be better for both of us, huh?
Chapter 43. Near Visegrad, Republika Srpska, Bosnia and Herzegovina. Brkić's unmarked panel van straddled the narrow asphalt lane, blocking the only road leading to the restaurant overlooking the river. Through his Gen 3 night vision monocular, he watched his men gathering in the trees above the restaurant, guns at the ready, faces masked. Blood-stained white eagle patches were sewn to their camouflage uniforms, trophies from an earlier war.
The same war, Brkić corrected himself. 26 years and counting.
Or was it 500? He swung his monocular down to the dining area, a covered porch with candle-lit tables and a spectacular daytime view of the rushing turquoise waters of the Drina River down below. Each table was crowded with hungry, happy wedding guests. The bride and groom's table stood at the end, their backs to Brkić's night vision device. Even from here he could smell the bitter tang of cigarettes and the smoky sweet aroma of grilled beef wafting in the soft breeze. It was a festive, joyous gathering, judging by the laughter and wide smiles. Heaping plates of steaming food and ice buckets full of beer and champagne were shuttled from the stucco two-story house across from the dining structure to the guests by servers in dark slacks, silk vests, and red bow ties. Brkić lowered his monocular, preparing to give the order. He paused. These were Sunni Muslims, like himself, celebrating a wedding, the joining of two families in the presence of God. This was a sacred time. A holy thing, wasn't it? He had no qualms about shedding the blood of Kafir Serbs and Croats. But this... wasn't everything he was planning designed to bless and save these very people? Several champagne corks popped all at once to cheers and clapping down below, followed by the tinkling of long-stemmed fluted glasses, a reminder to the fervent Chechen that these were secular people for whom Islam was a mere cultural expression, with no more meaning than a guide for manners. If they had faith at all, it was weak, and tempered by the pagan culture that surrounded and infected them. Red Wing was right. This was a hard thing, but necessary. The plan to save his people from the predations of the Christian West must move forward. Tonight, these Muslim people of such little faith would bring glory to Allah in their unwilling martyrdom. Brkić raised the radio to his mouth, gave the first order, then the second. Unleashing the fires of hell. 10 kilometers away, a small charge of C4 plastic explosive decimated the unoccupied blue-striped Polizia van parked next to a roadside bar. The two officers on duty that night were inside. This was their regular stop in the middle of the shift, to consume their free meal of flaky beef-stuffed bureks and strong coffee to get them through the rest of the night. They dashed outside at the sound of the thundering explosion, the catchlight of the wrecked and burning van dancing in their eyes. The firelight blocked the sight of the two masked White Eagles militiamen in camouflage stepping out of the shadows, but they caught the flash of their suppressed pistols. Both Bosniak cops crashed against the cinder block walls in a spray of blood from the force of the slugs slamming into their unprotected chests. They crumpled into a heap where they fell, and White Eagle's death cards were shoved into their gaping mouths. Brkić watched the unfolding mayhem as gunshots sparked inside the dining porch and echoed inside the restaurant. He barely heard the radio confirmation of the police assault above the plaintive screams of the wedding party. Men begging for their lives were shot in the mouth as their women were dragged outside by the hair to suffer the brutal frenzy of unleashed animals. He checked his watch. Another 15 minutes would be enough to finish the assault. His men had orders to spare the lives of the women, but not the men. They had already cut the one phone landline they could find, and a portable cell phone jammer in his van would take care of any guest who might try to call for help. Red Wing would be pleased that his loathsome orders had been carried out tonight. But soon Red Wing would discover that he wasn't in charge after all, when his world burned to the ground. Chapter 44. Near Dulvici, Bosnia and Herzegovina. Aida picked Jack up the next morning at his building. He met her at the curb. She was driving the same Volkswagen T5 Happy Times tour van they had ridden in yesterday. She greeted him with a smile, obviously glad to see him. She was as beautiful as he remembered. Maybe more so. It would be well worth the verbal ass-whooping Jerry would be handing him sometime later today for not getting on that plane. "I'm so glad you decided to come." "Me too," Jack said as he climbed into his seat. 30 minutes later, they were up in the pine-covered hills surrounding Sarajevo and pulling up to the entrance of the refugee center, with a banner proclaiming Peace and Friendship Center, Welcome, in Byzantski, English, and Arabic. It hung from the newly installed cyclone fence that surrounded the refurbished facility. The dated buildings were mostly made of rough-hewn logs and stacked stone, recently repaired with concrete, and were laid out in orderly fashion on relatively flat, open ground surrounded by trees. "What was this place?" Jack asked as Aida pulled through the front gate. "It was a summer camp for the League of Socialist Youth. It was abandoned years ago, after the socialists evaporated. It's perfect for our needs. Let me show you." She parked the van and led Jack into the first log and stone building, the medical clinic. Inside there were examination rooms, a nurse's station, and doors marked X-ray, lab, and the like. "We renovated the original, adding some basic medical equipment. We can perform routine health, dental, and eye exams, X-rays, and blood work."
"No surgeries?"
"No. We can send them to the hospital in Sarajevo for an emergency. These people have all been screened earlier for serious illnesses back in Greece or their point of entry. We're just taking care of basic needs like fevers, coughs, headaches, small cuts, that sort of thing. And to make sure big issues weren't missed earlier." Aida introduced Jack to a nurse passing by with a chart in her hand, and then a young female doctor who appeared with a hijab-clad mother and her young daughter. Aida knelt down and cooed with the shy child, provoking a wide smile from the mother and the child when she offered the girl a piece of candy from her pocket. They spent another few minutes meeting other staff, along with several more patients, all women in hijabs and their young children. The staff clearly respected her, and the patients all adored her, especially the children. Jack was impressed. She was pleased that he was. "There's much more to see." She led him to the rest of the camp, almost a village unto itself. A large kitchen and dining area, an administrative office, an education building, sleeping quarters for families and singles, along with storage and maintenance sheds. Aida explained that when the refugees first arrived, they were processed through the administration building, where they were enrolled for whatever Bosnian or international financial aid they qualified for. Next, they were assessed in their health, education, and employment status, and finally assigned sleeping quarters. The Peace and Friendship Association that sponsors this place also generously supplies a monthly stipend for the first 6 months they are here. Many of the people coming here are surprisingly well-educated and professional. Doctors, lawyers, accountants. But they're willing to do any kind of work to survive. "Where are all the men?" "I've only seen women and children," Jack said as they walked around the camp. The women appeared to be from all over the Middle East, to judge from the wide variety of ethnicities, but all of them were covered to one degree or another.
For the men who can find regular employment, we use our tour vans to run a shuttle from the refugee center to the city. But for the others who are still in transition, we operate a small furniture factory a few kilometers from here, and sell the furniture to help support the center, while giving them something meaningful to do and a chance to learn a new trade.
Why do you use your tour vans?
It's one small way my company can help and save the center the expense of hiring an outside firm.
It's amazing what you're doing here.
How many people can you accommodate? At full capacity, we can serve 200 people. The idea is to move people in and out of here as quickly as possible, depending upon their employment status. Most families move on within 2 months of arrival.
She looked around.
It's not exactly a 5-star hotel, but I think it is rather pleasant.
I've been in worse places, believe me.
You? I think you are one of those rich 1% Americans I keep reading about.
Hardly. Not that we were ever poor when I was growing up. My parents worked very hard and raised us to do the same.
Good. Then let's put you to work.
Jack smiled broadly.
That's why I'm here.
Aida dropped Jack off in the kitchen and pointed him at a giant stack of dirty breakfast dishes. Without batting an eye, Jack rolled up his sleeves, washed his hands, and filled up one of the big sinks with steaming hot water and sudsy soap.
I will check on you later, Aida said, heading back to the clinic.
When she did check back an hour later, not only had Jack cleaned and dried all of the dishes, he'd swept and cleared the dining hall, and he was just finishing up scrubbing the toilets.
I am impressed, Mr. Ryan. You know how to work.
What else do you need done?
Aida dragged him from building to building. The two of them worked together, cleaning, moving, and stacking as the need arose. Aida was as willing as Jack to get her hands dirty. There was a kind of friendly competition between them. In a storage room full of donated clothes, the two of them sorted and folded for an hour, sharing stories about their childhoods and their parents. Jack found that he did most of the talking, thanks to Aida's endless questions. He was still careful to avoid divulging his father's true identity.
But American doctors make a lot of money, yes?
Compared to some other people, yes. But not millions. Well, at least not my mom.
And your father, the bureaucrat? People in government here steal so much money, and they get very rich very fast.
Some of our politicians are crooked, too.
It's amazing how many poor congressmen become millionaires while in public service, Jack admitted.
But there are more honest people in government than not, and my dad is one of those. They folded the last shirts, and Aida led them outside. Jack nodded at a group of kids kicking a soccer ball around, laughing and shouting.
My company, Hendley Associates, has a charitable foundation. You should apply for one of their grants. This would fit in perfectly with Jerry's vision.
Aida's eyebrows lifted.
The senator, yes?
Yeah. Now that's a rich guy. But he worked hard for it, and he came by it honestly after he left office.
You admire him?
Yes. He's like a second father to me. As if on cue, Jack felt his phone vibrate in his pocket. He was sure it was Jerry. He ignored it.
Aida smiled coyly.
Then I can count on you to put in a good word for us with your foundation?
Sure.
Excuse me a minute. Jack bolted off to the soccer game and jumped into the middle of it.
Aida saw Jack laughing and smiling as much as the kids. She decided to join the game too, and a few minutes later, more kids came out to play.
Jack was a big hit. When lunchtime came around, the children begged him to sit with them, and of course he did. The rest of the day went the same way, with Jack helping teach an English language class and peeling potatoes back in the kitchen. Whatever needed to be done, he did it, working shoulder to shoulder with Aida. It was a total contrast to his normal life. Not that his life could be considered normal by any stretch. He was proud of what he did back home with the campus and Hendley Associates. But he had to admit, he hadn't been this happy in a long time.
They were back outside playing with the kids again when Aida checked her watch. There will be another bus arriving here any minute. We should greet it. Let's go. They left the kids and their teacher kicking a soccer ball around and headed for the front gate, just as a gleaming black Audi A8 sedan pulled up to the front office. The driver's door opened, and a suited chauffeur leaped out, then opened the rear passenger door. Ambassador Topal unfolded himself from the sedan and stood.
"Ambassador, it's so good to see you," Aida said.
Topal smiled, the corners of his eyes crinkling beneath his steel-rimmed glasses. He stretched out his hand.
"My dear Aida, hard at work as usual, I see."
He glanced at Jack.
"And I see you've recruited another volunteer."
He extended his hand to Jack.
"Good to see you again, Mr. Ryan."
"Please, Your Excellency, it's just Jack."
"What do you think of our little oasis?" Topal asked.
Aida explained, "The ambassador is the chairman of the Peace and Friendship Association. He has raised nearly all of the money from private contributions in Turkey for our facility."
"It's a wonderful place, and a very generous thing you are doing for these people."
Jack saw over Topal's shoulder that a giant Happy Times tour bus was making a wide turn from the road toward the gate. Jack felt a tug on his shirt sleeve. An 8-year-old girl, dirty blonde and green-eyed, stared up at him, smiling.
"Please, Jack, come play more."
Jack shrugged and said to Topal, "I think I'm being drafted into service."
"Then you should serve, as any good soldier does," Topal said, smiling.
The little girl began pulling on his sleeve with both hands like a one-man tug of war, giggling hysterically. He turned to Topal.
"You want to join us?"
"I'm sorry, but my old knees won't allow it."
He shook Jack's hand again.
"Enjoy your game. I still want you to come by my office sometime."
"It might have to be the next trip, but thanks."
Jack turned and sped away with the little girl, who shouted in Arabic to her cheering friends waiting for them on the field. Topal watched Jack resume his play as the bus's pneumatic brakes barked with a whoosh of air. He turned and whispered to Aida out of the side of his mouth.
"What is Jack Ryan doing here?"
"I told him to stay away."
"And yet, here he is."
"He's a good man. I'm not worried."
"A good man?"
"Yes,
perhaps he is."
"Which surprises me.
Your taste in men tends to run toward the opposite."
Topal removed his glasses and pulled a handkerchief from his suit pocket to clean them.
"My taste in men is no concern of yours. Everything about you concerns me these days."
The bus door finally opened and the first refugee stepped out, a bearded 25-year-old Tunisian male in jeans and a t-shirt. He shaded his eyes from the sun with one strong hand. He was followed by others just like him.
"This is not a good time for distractions."
"I'll do as I please," she said. "And Jack pleases me."
Topal finished wiping his glasses and put them back on, along with an affected smile.
"Let's go greet our new friends, shall we?"
Chapter 45. When Aida finished processing the new refugees, she stopped by the kitchen where Jack was helping prepare the evening meal.
"Time to get you back to your place, Jack. I'm sure you need to get packed for your flight."
"I don't have much to pack. I'm happy to stay longer if there's anything more I can do."
"Actually, I need to get you home so I can get back to my office. I have more paperwork to do tonight. Taxes are due."
Jack tried to hide his disappointment.
"Okay, sure. Let's go."
Aida pulled up to the curb at Jack's building just as the sun was beginning to set. The call to prayer echoed outside from the nearby mosque, beautiful and hypnotic, even muffled through the Volkswagen's glass.
"You did wonderful work today, Jack. I really appreciate it."
"I wish I could have done more for you."
"Perhaps when you get back to the States, you could spread the word.
We can always use more donations."
"You should come back with me. You'd sell it better than I could."
She set the parking brake.
"Don't tempt me."
"I am tempting you.
I could introduce you to some heavy hitters.
Heavy hitters?
Big money people who love to donate to causes like this. I might even be able to convince my dad to look into some kind of federal money or something. Your father must be a very important bureaucrat.
I'll tell him that.
Better yet, tell him yourself. Someday, I would like to visit your country, but now is not the time.
Jack heard the finality in her voice. He didn't want the day to end.
Man, I'm hungry. How about dinner?
I'm sorry, but I can't. I really do have a mountain of paperwork tonight, and tomorrow I'm leaving for Dubrovnik.
I've heard it's a beautiful city.
You have never been there?
No, but I'd like to someday.
Too bad you're flying home tomorrow.
She lowered her eyes.
If you were staying longer, I would take you there, and on the way show you more of my beautiful country.
Jack's heart raced, music to his ears. But he had checked his cell phone earlier in the day. 3 texts from Jerry, all with the same message. Call me. It was time to get home and get back to work.
Right. Why are you going to Dubrovnik?
I need to pick up some things for the medical clinic. I can make the drive in a day, but if you came, we'd do it in 2 days, like on one of my tours, so I can show you some amazing things that you may never see again.
I can change my plans.
Aida brightened.
So you'll come?
It's for the refugees, right? How can I say no?
While Jack was packing his underwear for the trip, Aida was in her office working on her books when Emir stormed in.
You're taking him to Dubrovnik?
Sure. Why not? He's never been there.
Is that wise?
I have to make the pickup anyway. Now I'll have company.
I don't like it.
Emir's sulking face betrayed him.
Of course you don't, my sweet cousin, Aida thought. It's only a courtesy. His mother is a surgeon. This is an easy way to repay her kindness to me.
She pitied Emir, and he knew it. That made him feel even worse. Emir's face hardened.
It's shameful.
Stop being so old-fashioned. We'll be in separate hotel rooms. It's only a kindness. I'm taking him on the same boring tour stops we've both done 1,000 times.
It doesn't look right.
What do I care what it looks like? I do as I please. How do you know he's not a spy?
Aida laughed.
A spy? Why? Because he's an American?
Yes, I see it now. He's a CIA assassin.
She laughed again.
Do not mock me, woman.
Aida recoiled inwardly at Emir's tone of voice. She'd never heard it from him before. Normally, she wouldn't take that from anybody. But his ego was wounded, and she cared for him, though not in the way he had hoped for since they were children. She never felt guilty about that. In fact, she used it to her advantage. She decided to forgive him the insult this one time. She pointed at the QuickBooks screen on her computer.
Do you see that?
That's what Jack does all day. He's a financial analyst, a numbers cruncher. He's no spy.
Believe me, I'd know.
It's too risky, even if he isn't a spy.
This life we live is full of risk. This is a small one at most. And Jack may help raise money for the refugee center.
She smiled at the irony.
Then I will go with you. You need protection. That isn't necessary. You have responsibilities here. We'll be fine.
I insist.
Aida stood.
You're being a fool. It's you who should be ashamed.
Emir's hands trembled slightly, but he didn't speak. A moment passed, and he willed his body to relax. She yanked open a drawer and pulled out a bottle of the Macallan single malt whiskey, along with 2 glasses.
Have a drink with me, like we used to do back in the old days.
She coaxed him with a teasing smile.
before you got religion.
Be careful with that man, was all he said, before he turned and headed for the door.
Emir,
the door slammed shut behind him.
Not good, Aida thought. But he'll get over it.
Chapter 46
Jack and Aida left early the next morning in the Happy Times Volkswagen tour van. The traffic in Sarajevo was heavy, but cleared up as soon as they passed the city limits heading west. Jack wore a pair of jeans and a polo shirt. Aida was equally casual in form-fitting Lululemon yoga pants, FK Sarajevo soccer jersey, and Ray-Ban aviators. Jack watched strands of her thick hair dancing in the air of the open driver's window.
Stunning.
They drove southeast about 30 miles through forested mountains to their first destination. According to the dashboard GPS display, they were coming into a little town named Kunitz.
Do all of your vehicles use GPS? Jack asked.
None of our drivers need it for directions, but it's a great way for Emir to keep track of vehicle locations, distances traveled, gas mileage, and that sort of thing.
Aida parallel parked on the main drag, directly in front of a magnificent stone bridge spanning the wide Neretva River. She yanked on the parking brake and smiled.
Let's check it out.
She led him to the center of the bridge and a commemorative plaque above the central pylon, written in Turkish and Bosnian. Jack deciphered enough to figure out that the bridge was built during the reign of the Ottoman Sultan Mehmet IV in 1682. Aida filled in the rest of the details.
Illyrian tribes first settled here 2,000 years ago, but others may have been here much earlier. The old stone bridge was destroyed by retreating German forces in 1945, but it was finally rebuilt in 2009 by Turkish engineers, using the exact same 17th-century building techniques and materials.
I'm betting the Turks don't rebuild Habsburg monuments, Jack said. Smart advertising on their part. A great way to display their generosity and promote their cultural hegemony, all at the same time.
Not that I'm aware of.
Jack took in the picture postcard view, a real Rick Steves moment. They could just stop here and be done as far as he was concerned.
Aida took his hand. Let's keep going. There's so much more to see.
Their next stop was Tito's bunker, a surrealistic trip back into the Cold War. The nuclear bomb shelter was secretly built by the communist dictator for himself and 300 hand-picked companions to survive a nuclear strike and live another 6 months. The people who ran the bunker now got the bright idea to not only preserve as much of the original furnishings and equipment as possible, but also to stage it with modern art exhibits throughout its many rooms, since the bunker itself was a strange kind of brutalist art form. After touring the bunker, they drove about 17 miles to the next town, Jablanica, which also bridged the Neretva River. About half of the drive was along the wide Jablanica Lake. Their destination was a large city park and museum, commemorating a famous victory by the Yugoslavian partisan forces against the Nazis in World War II. A blown railway bridge, half collapsed into the river, was still in place.
This is actually a bridge built and destroyed for a Yugoslavian war movie, but it looked so good and so real, the Tito government decided to leave it.
They jumped back into the van, the road generally following the track of the wide and winding Neretva River through the tree-covered mountains. The sky was crystal blue, warmed by a pleasant late-morning sun. The farther they drove, the more Jack fell in love with the people and the scenery, which at times was quite dramatic. It was another reminder to him how big the world was, and how many fascinating places there were that he had yet to discover. 100 generations of people he had never really thought about had lived in this magnificent country. Too many of them had died in the wars that plagued the area since the time of the Caesars. But for all of the interest he was taking in the tour, he was mostly curious about the woman driving the tour van. She fielded every question he had about geography and culture and local delicacies. And while she was amazingly well-versed in the history of the Ottoman sultans and the Habsburg emperors,
She remained politely evasive when he probed about her own personal history, which made her all the more intriguing. Still, he kept trying. So, you've never been married? Jack's feet were up on the dashboard while Aida drove on the curving two-lane.
No.